BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Well, I'm John Pienaar. Thanks for clicking on the Pienaar's Politics podcast for another week. And it's going to be quite a week, isn't it? I'm not going to spoil the content of the show or preempt too much because it's all right there. Have a listen. Morning, I'm John Pienaar. Welcome to Pienaar's Politics. That's assuming politics is the right term for the directionless and wildly unpredictable bun fight we could see at Westminster this week as the battle of Brexit reaches a defining moment, the biggest potential crisis till the next one. Who'll be truly in charge of events after Theresa May's Brexit plan is defeated? Because we can surely presume it will be, and safely assume it won't be her. Could she somehow hang on and keep playing for time? Because she'll try. Or Parliament, if MPs across parties seize control and, who knows, delay or even stop Brexit. Brexiteer Cabinet Minister Chris Grayling is on live in a moment. He might even spare a moment to answer those who say that his handling of the Transport Department has become a bad joke. And what about Labour? Which Labour, you might ask? Jeremy Corbyn, who wants a general election but surely won't get one and isn't keen on a fresh Brexit referendum? Or the many MPs and big majority of Labour members who want their party to swing behind having a people's vote, as they call it? Well, the Labour politician with the biggest direct mandate in the country, London Mayor Sadiq Khan, is on too. And speaking of a referendum, Brexiteer Ian Duncan-Smith's chipping in, so's Liverpool FC legend Jamie Carragher, and the Love Islander Zara McDermott, who came out for Brexit and apparently took a hail of abuse for it. Even worse, apparently, than most contestants on Love Island sign up for. So loads to talk about, loads of people to talk to and with us through all of this. Sienna Rogers is back, the editor of Labour List. Hi, Sienna.
Hi, John.
And Kate Andrews is here, Associate Director at the Institute of Economic Affairs, the free market think tank. Hello to both of you. Let me just ask you both, first of all, Sienna, how do you feel about this coming week coming up? Are you relieved it's coming to something of a head? Are you alarmed? Are you terrified?
Pretty alarmed because, okay, so this vote on Tuesday is obviously historic. It's so important. And yet we all know basically what's going to happen. It's about the size of this defeat, but it's going to be thumping whatever happens. So actually, we're kind of all looking forward to this process coming to an end, some sort of conclusion, but it doesn't seem like a conclusion. It's in sight, certainly not this week.
Yeah, Kate, what do you think?
Well,
how do you feel?
I'm speechless, which doesn't bode well for a radio program. But honestly, it is remarkable. Sienna's completely right. We know that the vote is very, very unlikely to pass. But if you look at the headlines this morning, the Express, the Prime Minister saying it'll be catastrophic if you don't vote this way, the Times talking about plots behind her back, nobody seems to know what direction this is going in except that it's going to be very painful. It's going to be a painful process.
Well, what about then the IEA in this, a free market think tank? Are you independent in this, or as a free market organ, are you all for Brexit? I mean, some people say you've got a secret agenda in the background on all sorts of things. You get money from the tobacco companies, some say, and the Americans' private health companies. Have you got an agenda here, or are you independent of all of it?
Well, no one can buy our position on Brexit because the IEA doesn't have a position on Brexit. Our spokespeople have different perspectives on this. We've released podcasts about the Norway option to doing briefings for a no-deal Brexit. So completely independent in that sense.
Now, you're not a sort of undercover lobbyist for any big interests?
Not in the slightest. We're an educational charity and very proud to be one.
I thought you'd say that, Kate. And what about you, Sienna? What's Labour List's position on this, if you have won a referendum and so on?
We haven't got a position on whether to hold a people's vote or not. I mean, this is such a divisive issue for the Labour Party. I think it would be weird, frankly, for Labour List to take a position on that because...
Except Labour List is a forum for members.
Yeah.
And the members are overwhelmingly in favour, to take that example, very much in favour of a referendum.
I think it's reasonable to say that the membership is overwhelmingly in favour of a people's vote, but the leadership isn't. And, you know, we've got to kind of... It is an open forum for members and for activists. And kind of the comment pieces and the balance there reflects that. But at the same time, the fact that lots of MPs are incredibly concerned by what a people's vote would mean for the Labour Party and our electoral chances.
Okay, well, whatever important. Your position may be or may not be, feel free to say what you think on this programme, certainly for the next hour or so. We're going to start by talking, as promised, to the Transport Secretary, Chris Grayling, who's joined us on the line. Good morning, Chris.
Hello there.
Let's start with this, Tuesday's big vote. It is, isn't it, about how big a defeat it turns out to be for the government and Theresa May, rather than whether you'll lose. The estimates, they go from anything between a defeat of 60 or 80 votes to 200.
Well, there's an awful lot of speculation around. I think we should wait and see what happens. A lot of work taking place at the moment to convince people this is the right thing to do.
Yeah.
My concern is that if Parliament moves in and overturns Brexit,
yeah.
It will destabilise our political system in a way that has not happened for a very, very long time indeed.
Well, let's talk about that, because there's a lot of talk this morning, as you know, about scheming among ministers and MPs to rule out the possibility of leaving with no deal. And I'm going to come to that in a second. But you raised the reaction. There you were in the Daily Mail newspaper yesterday, saying if we end up with no Brexit, it'll fuel a furious reaction from the far right. So isn't it just wrong, Chris, to argue fear of the hard right should be what decides this country's future?
Well, it's not a question of fear of the hard right should define this country's future. There are 17.4 million people who voted to leave. We had a national referendum. It was the biggest popular expression of view.
Well, I've heard
issue.
That view before, but yesterday you were in print saying we should all be wary and afraid of the idea of the far right reaction. Well, that's not a democratic argument.
So my concern is that we will see, if we turn around to those 17.4 million people and we simply say, hey, you know you voted to leave the European Union, well, Parliament has changed its mind and we're not going to after all. That will lead to the emergence in this country of the kind of populist political force or forces that we are seeing in other parts of Europe. Most other European countries at the moment have got new type populist political parties at the political extremes, either established or emerging. I do not want that to happen in this country. But if we say to those people, there's 17.4 million people, that conventional politics is now not going to deliver you what you voted for, we've changed your mind for you, I think there will be a political consequence for that.
But what a change, Chris. I mean, go back not very far to when you walked out of the cabinet to campaign for Brexit. Then it was supposed to be about a better, more prosperous Britain, free of the European Union, not fear of politics turning ugly or disorder on the streets. How the tone has changed.
Well, I still believe it's the right thing to do. I mean, my view, my reason for campaigning in the first place was I don't believe you can have a single currency without a single government. I think Europe is going to have to integrate more and more and more. I don't believe that's right for Britain. I still hold that view. The British public voted for Brexit.
Mm.
The Prime Minister has come up with a package that I think is a sensible compromise. It doesn't give everybody what they want. And indeed, the fact you've got both sides of the argument saying it doesn't give us what we want suggests maybe it's not far off the right balance. If somebody had offered me the Prime Minister's deal back in 2016 before the referendum and he had said to me, you can have this instead of staying in the European Union, I would have said thank you very much and accepted it. The point is, if we turn around now and say to people, do you know what, you voted to leave but we're not going to, and there are many people out there who are trying very hard to make sure that is what happens, then I think there is a big political price for our democracy to pay.
Well, let's look at no deal, because you know, there's an awful lot of preparation. Some of it, when you look at the you know, the bald facts of what's being proposed is quite hair-raising, but there you are in your department. And hiring a ferry company, Chris, to keep goods moving if there's no deal, a company that doesn't have any ferries, whatever else it wasn't a triumph of reassurance, was it?
Well, look, let's see what I've actually done. I've hired two major ferry operators, Brittany Ferries and DFDS, to operate several routes around the UK coast to ease pressures on Dover and Calais and on the tunnel if necessary.
Have they got any ships yet?
Well, DFDS and P&O and Brittany Ferries operate the biggest networks in around some of the biggest networks around
yes,
the country.
Yes, they do.
So
but the company, this is the company that.
Okay, so I also received a proposal from a small new business, which has a plan to launch a service from Ramsgate to Ostend, for a small proportion of what I was looking to get, and we have agreed that they can do that with us if they deliver the service. We pay no money at all to them unless they deliver the service. We've had their business plan validated by serious external advisor, Slaughter and May on the legal side, Deloitte on the financial side, Mott MacDonald on the deliverability side. So we believe they have a credible business plan. But if they don't, and if it doesn't happen, then we haven't paid any money. But there is no basis for us to turn around to a British startup and say, guys, you're small, you're new, so we don't trust you, so we're not going to work with you.
Yeah.
We're giving them the chance.
It was
but
PR,
we won't
Chris,
pay
wasn't
any money.
It? It was about hiring a British company, just so you could say you've hired a British company.
No, not at all. It was about receiving a compliant bid with a business plan that's stacked up and accepting it for a small proportion. This is 10% of the extra capacity we've contracted for, and we don't pay any money unless they deliver the service. That's the key point. We're not paying any money. We haven't contracted them. We haven't given them anything. We just said, we'll pay you. We're effectively buying tickets on ships, and if those ships don't sail, we don't buy the tickets.
Okay, and what about hiring 80-odd lorries paying them up to rehearse parking on an airfield in Kent. That was PR, not preparation, surely.
Well, there's a whole variety of tests going ahead at the moment. I do not want us to have the same kind of disruption in Kent that we had in 2015, when there was massive disruption around the Channel ports. The whole M20 was closed for weeks. Mm. We do not want that to happen again.
Well, exactly. So we've replaced something like 10,000 lorries use this route every day, and there are 80 lorries trundling up and down the road.
This is one of a series of tests that we're doing. This particular one was to do with the movements in and out of the airport, how quickly a small group of lorries move in and out of the airport, testing something called Operation Tap on the A256, where you have a queue of lorries and just how quickly people can arrive and depart from that. And when you're carrying out a test, you ask for more people to come along than you actually need. The test was fine. It was carried out for us by Highways England, Kent County Council. The officials carrying it out said they got the information they needed from it. People jumped to conclusions. This wasn't an attempt to create a giant traffic jam. Of course it wasn't. We had enough lorries to do that. What we're trying to do is just test movements, test how to operate Manston Airfield, which has not been used before as a pressure easer on the M20. So we're doing a whole lot of exercises.
Okay, let's talk about the tangle that could transpire from Tuesday. And just briefly on this, in a word, several of your colleagues in the Cabinet, Jeremy Hunt, Amber Rudd, they've said, haven't they, that Parliament won't allow a Brexit with no deal. Do you, first of all, in a word, agree with that? Do you think Parliament wouldn't wear it? It wouldn't happen?
Well, Parliament doesn't want it, but of course things can happen. I don't think anybody wants a no deal, but things can happen.
Things can happen, and that's my point on this question.
That's why we're preparing in case, but it's not what our goal is, but it's absolutely not what we want.
Okay, so following from that, are you worried about reports, fascinating reports in the papers, including the Sunday Times this morning, of plotting among MPs to seize control of the Brexit process by maybe changing the rules to give MPs, not ministers, the power to put proposals before the Commons and see them voted through? Are you worried about that kind of scheming?
Well, I mean, my message to anybody who's thinking of that is this is not just a one-off over Brexit. You would change the whole nature of the passage of legislation in the future.
So you are worried
about
that?
Well, I think it would be a huge mistake for anyone in Parliament to think that changing the rules in this particular way over Brexit is the right thing to do. It would cause long-term problems for governments of all persuasions to get legislation through. It would change the whole nature of our parliamentary system. I think it would be a big mistake.
It's suggested, isn't it, that it would stop the government simply being able to govern.
Well, I mean, you would not be able to guarantee you could bring forward legislation in the way that government can do. So when people say we need you to do this for us, government will no longer be able to guarantee that it can do it.
OK, you're clearly worried about that. And as part of all of this, the Speaker of the House of Commons, John Bercow, he's being accused of quite a lot of things. He's being accused of bias, even unconstitutional bias, against Brexit and against the government by, as some believe, maybe allowing this to happen. Do you share that view that John Bercow is behaving quite improperly?
Well, I think what I would say, I've known the Speaker for a long time, and I hope he will refrain from doing anything that would cause controversy around his position, and I think would undermine the credibility of the Office of Speaker. The job of the Office of Speaker is to be impartial, to be a dispassionate referee of proceedings in the House, and I very much hope that over the coming days and the coming weeks, that's what he will do.
Would that threaten his position then? I mean, you raised the idea that it would threaten his legitimacy as Speaker. Would it put him at risk of being kicked out of the chair?
I'm not going to start issuing threats against the Speaker. I'm not going to start speculating on his position. All I would hope is that he will conduct the office of Speaker in a way that is appropriate, in a way that is consistent with the way that the office of Speaker should be operated.
Okay, let me ask you this. I want to bring Kate and Sienna in too, briefly. An idea being floated too is MPs might get a chance to vote to decree that Britain should leave any relationship with the EU. I'm talking about the backstop now, under which we'd be tied to EU rules, Northern Ireland tied even closer if there's no deal in place by, say, the end of 2021. Would you support a time limit being built into the withdrawal agreement to say that will not happen, that it is temporary until that date?
Well, I mean, clearly one of the things the Prime Minister has been very, very clear about when it comes to the backstop is that we would prefer to have an arrangement which is a temporary arrangement. Yeah. And actually, it will help the agreement get through Parliament. It will help the European Union and us move forward from this. It's in as much of their interest as ours to make sure that we have a smooth transition to the future. What they don't want, in my view, is a disruptive Brexit. I don't think we want a disruptive Brexit. I campaigned in 2016 to leave, but to leave on good terms, maintaining maintaining good, friendly, neighbourly relations, and that's where I think we should be. And frankly, I hope we're all working together to make sure that can happen.
Well, the thing is, we know your preferences, Chris, and we know that Brussels says the same thing. It's going to be temporary. We want it to be temporary, not to drag on. But would it be a good idea to build into the actual agreement being voted on this week that any such tie-in should be ended by, say, the end of 21, to put a date in that? Would that be something you'd support?
Well, yes, of course. I mean, the Prime Minister herself said that she doesn't think this should last more than a year.
By preference, but should it be built in as a requirement?
Well, I mean, we'll see what Parliament says, but I mean, there's no doubt the government's position would be that we want that to be built into the process leaving, the agreements around leaving.
Interesting, because if that were the case, you'd be voting, Parliament would be voting, to take on the option of breaching an international treaty, because you can put that in the British deal, but if Brussels doesn't agree with it and there's no deal in place by the end of 2021, say, and you walked away, that's a breach of a treaty. No, what would that mean for Britain's standing?
I think you're misunderstanding me. What I'm saying is I want us to agree that with the European Union.
Oh, sure, but what about putting it in the bill? I'll get back to the first point then. Well, you would not oppose that.
We'll see. There's a lot of speculation around with these things. I mean, I am in favour of there being a time limit to the Brexit, to the backstop. It's clearly something that's got to be, I think, in my view, agreed with the European Union, but I think it's in their interests to do that. I really genuinely do.
Okay. You're going to duck that one. We'll see how that plays out. Kate and Sienna here.
Well, let's be honest. If the legal text of the withdrawal agreement is not changed, then anything that the MPs vote on and creating a time limit to that backstop is not going to be held up in the same way if the EU doesn't agree to it. It's not that safety net that I think the British public, especially those who voted to leave, are looking for.
Sienna.
I just wanted to quickly return to the first question about your warning of the far right. If we stop Brexit, could lead to a rise to the far right. But would you include, for instance, Nigel Farage in that? I mean, who were you talking about when you're talking about the far right?
I'm not going to comment on individuals. I think that would be the wrong thing to do. But look, what I think we will see...
Would it? He comments on you quite a lot.
Well, he may do. But look, I think,
of course, you shared a platform with him during the referendum and repeated his slogan of "We want our country back." So I'm just wondering who you were referring to by the far right. If not Nigel Farage, then who?
So what I was saying is that we've seen in pretty much every other country in Europe the emergence of new significant political parties at the political extremes. And my concern is that if we say to those 17.4 million people who voted to leave, actually, guys, we're not leaving after all, we will see the emergence of a new political force like that that will come to have a real impact on our politics.
Chris, there is talk, isn't there, of Brexiteer ministers like you being maybe willing to resign rather than accept any delay to Brexit, any putting off of Article 50 for whatever reason. Would you resign if there was any delay of that kind?
Look, there's lots of speculation about lots of people around. I can assure you, if I was going to resign, the first person who would know would be Theresa May and no one else.
All right, with that relatively unhelpful reply. But thanks for coming on, Chris. It's
You're
good
welcome,
to talk
John.
To you, as always. Sadiq Khan has come into the studio to join us now. Hi, Sadiq.
Hi, John.
Good to see you. Look, I'm going to come to Brexit in a minute, obviously, as you can imagine. Can I just talk for a moment about crime?
Of course.
Because that is such a huge story growing story, very much in your intro, very much on your patch. We had the other day that awful story of a 14-year-old boy knocked off his moped and stabbed. We got the highest number of homicides in the City of London for a decade last year. Now, you're the police authority for the capital. Are people perfectly entitled to say, are you doing your job?
Well, I was with Jaden's family on Friday, and I'm sure all of us have in our thoughts and prayers his family and what they're going through at this difficult time. We've done a number of things over the last 2.5 years since I became mayor to grapple with the issue of the rise in violent crime. It's been going up since 2014 across the country, including London. And that's why, in the context of the massive cuts from central government, I don't apologise for being the first mayor in some time to raise council tax. I've raised it for 3 years in a row now to try and fill the massive hole left by the government. But also I've diverted monies away from business rates to support our police. So the massive cliff edge our police were going to fall off isn't yet happening. Mm. We've managed to manage the decline, if you like, of falling police numbers. At the same time, though, invest in young people. So again, I don't apologise for diverting monies towards young Londoners. We've got a new £45 million Young Londoners Fund to give young people constructive things to do, because the police told me, and I agree with them, we aren't going to arrest ourselves out of this violent crime problem that we have. So we've got to have a public health approach. And again, I've been talking about this for some time now, looking at the lessons from Glasgow and around the world where they've managed to not just reverse the trend, but to deal with violent crime. What does that mean?
that well, means... Let me ask you what it means in one particular case.
Sure.
Because not too long ago, you promised greater use of stop and search powers by the police. Has that happened? To what extent has that power, the use of that power, grown? And has it made any difference?
Yeah, it has happened. Let me see the game changer for there. The game changer was, in London, we have had the biggest rollout of body-worn videos of any police force in the country. That means every police officer now carries a body-worn video. Why is that important? It's important to give Londoners confidence that when a police officer uses this really important tool of stop and search, that you have safeguards as a citizen. But it gives the police confidence to know there won't be what used to be called vexatious complaints made by members of the public. The good news, we've had an increase in targeted intelligence-led stop and search. The good news, this has led to a huge number of people being arrested, charged, prosecuted, but also thousands of knives being taken off our street. And the good news also is complaints haven't gone up. So it's a good example of the police having an effective tool, but the public knowing the police are still policing by consent.
Because there was been a controversy about this for many years back to when I was a young reporter on
Me
the
too.
South London
too,
Press in this city about stop and search, and how
this.
It was disproportionately used against, say, black and minority community, young people. That's an important accusation which needs to be addressed, isn't
it's still a concern in 2019. And
you make no apologies for that.
Here's the concern. The concern is if stop and search has been used in an indiscriminate, on an industrial scale manner without the proper safeguards. So look, how can you, as a young person who is stopped and searched wrongly today, treated badly, and go back and tell this to your family, how can we expect you tomorrow to provide invaluable intelligence to stop crimes being prevented? So it's in all of our interests to get stop and search right. And that's why I say to those members of the London community who understandably have concerns about the use of stop and search, we now have the biggest safeguards of any police force in the world. But also this is an invaluable tool to keep us all safe.
Okay, I don't want to dwell too long on it. It's not just a London issue. This is an issue for the entire country, but I don't want to dwell on it for too long. I simply haven't got the time. So I'm going to ask you a bit about Brexit.
Sure.
In your view, Sadiq, has the response of the leadership of your party in relation to Brexit been adequate?
Well, Jeremy Corbyn has a response which respects the motion passed by our conference, which is a sequential response, which I support. And the response is this. On Tuesday, when the vote happens in Parliament, I would hope all MPs, of course Labour MPs, to vote against this deal negotiated by our Prime Minister. I think it's a bad deal. The next best thing, once this has been defeated, is for, as far as I'm concerned, as a Labour supporter, for this shower of a government to be voted out. The only way to do that is by a general election. If we don't succeed in persuading Parliament for there to be a new general election, the next best thing is for the public to take back control of this very, very important
decision. So far, that answer is right off the songbook, the Labour Party songbook. But I started off the show by saying Jeremy Corbyn is not one bit keen on a fresh referendum on the European Union, on Brexit. Are you going to take issue with that suggestion or that?
But with respect, John, there's a good reason for that, because Jeremy Corbyn, not unreasonably, as the leader of Her Majesty's official opposition, wants to be the Prime Minister. And, you know, that's why the first thing to do once this vote is defeated, as I hope it is for the Labour Party to put down a motion of confidence. Let's see if there's a will of the British Parliament to have another general election. If they decline that option, then I think the next best thing is a public vote. It's quite clear Parliament's in gridlock. It's quite clear that the promises made 2-3 years ago have not been met. Yeah.
But that, you're clear. Being a little disingenuous here, right?
No.
It is suggested in your party by people who know what's going on that the leader of your party really doesn't want a referendum, and some in the shadow cabinet very much do, wish he'd be a bit more robust in joining their side of the argument.
Well, look, I'm hoping if the option of a general election is defeated in Parliament, I'm hoping there is a public vote. I'm hoping the British public do take back control. I'm hoping this campaign is a more positive one. But I'll tell you this, the idea that we should allow a fear of the far right to dictate our policy, I find astonishing. The far right, for example, wouldn't want somebody who looks like me to be the Mayor of London. Does that mean I don't stand to be the Mayor of London? The far right don't want many, many things. The idea that this government is capitulating to the far right as a reason for holding a public vote, I find astonishing.
Yeah, is it astonishing, though? I mean, you have discussed this with Chris Greening just a second ago, but does he not have something of a point? which is that if Brexit is kiboshed at this stage, there would be a furious reaction in a large part of the country, and some of those sort of pro-Brexit on the right of the spectrum, maybe they'd be most active in cashing in jumping in on this issue, and would gain as a consequence.
Well, this is why Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour Party, myself, many others are so critical of this government's stance over the last 2 years. There was no need at all to serve the Article 15 notice when Prime Minister May did. No reason at all. So the clock is running down, and we have this false narrative of a bad Brexit deal or no deal whatsoever. And the Prime Minister is brazenly blackmailing MPs to support a bad deal. And actually, by the way, the best way to heal divisions and to deal with issues of discord isn't to bury them away, which is what a bad deal would do or no deal, but to address those. And I think actually a public vote would be cathartic, but also a proper campaign. Now we know the mistruths. Now we know some of the tricks used by the Brexit campaign would be addressed in a new public vote.
Well, there were tricks on both sides, weren't there, and faulty statistics bandied around. I can't think of a time in recent history where we've needed more bipartisan effort from politicians, not more calls for elections and referendums. But if I may quickly go back to the violence point at the beginning, I agree with you, Mayor Khan, that actually more funding is probably needed, although council tax may not be the way to do it. It's been increased by 60% over the past 20 years. But isn't the elephant in the room drug reform? Isn't it time that a progressive Labour Party came out and really tackled this issue, especially around cannabis, but potentially other drugs, to say, you know what, we need to reform these laws. We need to at least decriminalise, because it's disproportionately affecting our minority communities.
The big issue about drugs here. So just to underscore your point, we now know unequivocally there is a direct link between the increase in violent crime, drugs and organised crime. And the young children we see being killed on our streets across the country are a consequence of this massive, massive trade. I personally am not in favour of legalising drugs, but the point you make is a much more fundamental one, which is on a bipartisan level, politicians with experts having a grown-up discussion around drugs legislation. I'm happy to do so. My concern is this: an impression has been created that somehow when you take drugs, which may not be dangerous to yourself, that there isn't a cost of doing so. And so the point the commissioner's made, I've made, and many others have made, including senior judges, is when, and I'm sorry to make a generalisation, but when at some dinner parties, middle-class Londoners are taking drugs, thinking there's no consequence at the same time as buying, you know, organic coffee and organic food, don't think there isn't a consequence. And so this hypocrisy is what concerns me. But you're right, there is a link, and we've got to address that link. But can I just deal with one point of this?
Yeah.
The idea that more democracy is somehow a bad thing, I don't accept.
More politicalization, more efforts to divide than unite. The Labour Party constantly calling for themselves to be put into power, as opposed to saying, you know what, there may be a time and a place for that general election, but right now there was a vote in 2016. We need to come together with the Conservatives and the Lib Dems to get Brexit over the line in a compromise kind of way.
I'm happy to be lectured about votes by anybody, but the idea that somebody who supports a party who called a general election in 2017 for no other reason but because Theresa May was 20 points ahead and wanted to decimate the Labour Party, I don't quite accept.
Well, I don't support that party.
Let me get Sienna. Sienna, we've got a question first.
I'm wondering whether there is, in your belief, such a thing as a sensible jobs first Brexit.
Good question. So one of the things that we did about a year ago is published an independent analysis done by Cambridge Econometrics, looking at the various different options of us leaving the European Union. And we asked the question, which should be the least worst, if you like? And they did six options. One is we stay in the single market, we stay in the customs union with the long transition, all the way to no deal whatsoever, leaving straight away. What's clear from this independent analysis is all of the options are less good than us being a member of the European Union. Mm-hmm. But actually the least worst is us having a decent transitional period, being a member of the single market and being a member of the customs union. But actually they forecast that on each of the six different options, the growth over the next 10 years would be less good in all six options than it would if we stayed in the European Union. That's not to say I don't accept there's an argument and a need for reforming the European Union, but actually all the scenarios show less growth going forward than if we stay in the European Union.
So, is there hard evidence of approaching Brexit having a dampening effect on the economy in the capital? What's the evidence for that? Beyond generalised assertions of business being worried, what's the hard evidence?
So we've seen a slowdown in the economy in London. We're seeing this on construction in London, a slowdown in relation to construction taking place in London's developers pausing good news is that capital's not leaving London, but not starting construction on the projects they previously had. They're also telling me about some of their staff who, inverted commas, returned home during summer, not coming back. So we've lost some of our construction builders. The NHS has record numbers of shortages amongst their staff. You all know NHS social care recruit a large number of EEA citizens. We've seen businesses across London noticing this economic slowdown, demonstrated by the numbers. So there is evidence already there of a slowdown in London's economy. I'll give you one simple example. One of the explanations experts give for the increase on public transport not rising as much as it has in previous years is because of the economic slowdown. And there is a big concern if we have a bad Brexit deal, or even worse, no deal whatsoever, that slowdown would accelerate.
And over time, though, I'm talking to Ian Duncan Smith in a minute. He might well say, look, maybe there'll be some bumps in the road, to quote another Brexiteer, David Davis, but in the end, the country will survive, the country will prosper, London will do very well.
Oh, look, of course our country will survive, and of course London will do very well. The underlying strengths of our city will still be there. A great ecosystem, some of the best universities in the world, a great legal system. That sort of enthusiasm and optimism that we have as a city. But my point is, we would be more successful, and we could be more successful with being a member of a reformed European Union. And my concern is, if a false narrative is given of, you know, accept this bad Brexit deal, or the alternative is no deal whatsoever, that's blackmailing MPs to vote a certain way. I think MPs should be brave and vote to reject the deal on Tuesday. And if we can't get a general election, the next best thing is for the public to take back control, bearing in mind there is gridlock in Parliament.
OK, Sadiq Khan, thanks for coming in. I'm overrunning. What's new? I was overrun. I'm John Pienaar. This is Pienaar's Politics. Sienna Rogers is here from the Labour List, and Kent Andrews from the Institute of Economic Affairs. And now hello to Ian Duncan Smith on the line, the former leader of the Conservative Party. Morning, Ian.
Morning.
Hi. Can I pick up a thread with you that I was talking to Chris Grayling, the Cabinet Minister, a moment ago. Jeremy Hunt, Foreign Secretary, Amber Rudd, the DWP Secretary, among others, are saying Parliament won't allow us to leave with no deal. Do you accept that for a moment?
No.
Why not?
Because Parliament's already voted to leave on March the 29th. It's legislated for it. That legislation now is in statute. To overturn that or to change that requires statute. The only people that can overturn the statute and bring legislation forward is the government.
Yeah.
And Theresa May has said constantly, we leave on March the 29th. And my personal view about all of this is that this deal genuinely isn't good enough, and will almost certainly be voted down. But I think that's when the negotiations with the EU really begin in earnest. I think the EU, as we saw during the week when Greg Hans, a fluent German speaker married to a German speaking German at home, reads all the German periodicals, spotted that Martin Selmayr had said in an interview that the EU had got absolutely everything it wanted, and basically that, as far as they were concerned, the UK would have to put up with the rest. In fact, at one point, I think he and others said that Northern Ireland's departure, as it were, from the UK was a price they would have to pay. So, in other words, they don't think for one moment that they did other than succeed massively in what was a pretty poor set of negotiations. I think the only thing that makes them sit up, and I got this impression when I was talking with Monsieur Barnier and Sabine Weyand and others when I went over there about 5 weeks ago, that actually the only thing that really matters to them is getting their deal and getting their money. And once they think that's threatened, that's when they'll go back to the table and properly discuss.
But if you're right about that, when you're quoting Martin Selmayr, who's a big figure in the European Commission, if you're right about that, then they won't give more. If it's correct, they feel in Brussels they got the best thing and more they could ever get, why would they make more concessions?
Because there are things that they desperately want from us. 39 billion, already they're warning that if the UK leaves without a deal, the budget commissioner said over Christmas, he has warned every single one of the nations that as soon as that happens, that he will be coming to them for very significant increases in their budget, because the UK is such a significant player in that budget. So first of all, in the next 2 years, because we wouldn't be involved in a transition period, that would be about 22 billion net that would leave the EU. Therefore, they have to find that in the next 2 years. And the other bit is the remaining part of the 39, which actually is probably nearer 44 billion, which is spread over a number of years. But they would also have to ante up for the whole of that when they get to the new budget setup. So the EU has always wanted to fill that hole, number one. And the second thing they've always wanted is they've wanted the UK very much tied to the EU even after they leave. And that's pretty much what they've been trying to get. If they sink for one moment and believe that the EU is actually A, not going to pay that money, and B, going to sit on the outside of the EU in a much more competitive nature. That also deeply concerns them. There's one other point, too. I did listen to the tail end of your interview with the mayor, who goes on about what's good and what's bad and forecasts for trade and how trade is supposed to be falling off in the UK. In fact, none of the national figures show that to do with Brexit. What goes missing in all these discussions is just have a look around the rest of the world. We had a fall off in car sales of about 2%. People were saying, oh, that's to do with Brexit. Actually, it's not. If you look at Germany, their fall off in car sales is 4%. If you look at China, it's 40%. China is now facing the real threat of deflation, which is affecting the global economy and will affect it dramatically. You know, this is not to do with Brexit. This is to do with lots of other issues. And in fact, the one market that JLR have managed to increase their sales to, strange enough, is the United States. And I didn't, last time I looked at it, think that the United States was part of the EU or the customs union. So it does show that actually all these threats and worries are absolutely, utterly bogus.
But if we leave with no deal, then those big car makers in the northeast of this country, for example, they're going to have problems getting their components in or out without bureaucracy and the cost that goes with it. And there's lots of talk of them scaling down future investment and all sorts of other things that are going to harm that part of the country and others.
Well, we say that, but let's have a look at it. Let's get a few facts on the table. The so-called supply chain first in time, many of them talk about an absolute first just-in-time supply chain. Not all of them actually do operate under that. But even if we took that for one second, have a look at where most of the parts come from. For the British car industry, 63% of their supply chain is either in the UK or away from the European Union. About 34-35% of their supply chain, give or take variations, actually comes within the EU. And remember when we had that massive block...
But you need all your parts to make a car, don't you?
Yeah, yeah, but hold on a second. Remember when we had that massive blockage in 2015 that lasted over 2 or 3 weeks? I don't recall a single car maker telling us that they were having to stop production because they didn't have the parts that were necessary to come. The reality is that all around the world... parts are shipped and moved on a regular basis and allowed for. I used to, as a publisher, export every single country in the world. All the allowances you make and all these so-called costs are simply not correct because many of them are repeat transfers, which means they are simply repeated customs points that come across.
The head of the CBI the head of the CBI spoke about an investment plan in the northeast of the country, clearly referring to a car company, £100 million, which had been cancelled, future investment of £100 million in anticipation of the problems of Brexit.
Well, again, be very careful why people are thinking about their investments. Globally, the car industry is facing serious pressures for two good reasons. The first is because of the fall off in sales of diesel cars. Many of the car manufacturers, and Jaguar Land Rover probably more than most, put their eggs in the basket of diesel. Since the Volkswagen problem, people have stopped buying diesel cars. As I said earlier on, fall off in sales in Germany are twice what they are here in the UK, and that's happening all over the world. The second thing, which is quite important about this, is that Toyota went ahead with their major investment, which takes them past Brexit. So it isn't all one way. And the final point I make, all these threats and crisis points that I keep saying, there was a very good interview with the man that runs Calais and Boulogne the other day on the Today programme. And he was absolutely crystal clear. They are not going to have any extra checks, that they will make sure there are no queues, no problems, because their business relies on getting British manufacture and British agriculture and other parts through. So when he said that, that becomes clear that the plans that the government says there'll be stackbacks, there won't be stackbacks because they would only happen if Calais decided to block the port, they're not.
I want to get Kate and Sienna in. Kate and Sienna.
Hi, Ian. It's Sienna from Labour List here. Yes. I wanted to ask about, away from the technicalities of no deal, but just the approach of the Prime Minister. I mean, you've been a Tory leader, obviously, and, you know, lots of Labour MPs agree that it's her approach, kind of authoritarian approach, that has actually led to this situation that we've got now. Do you think that she could have taken a different approach with Labour MPs in particular? You know, because there's lots who you might expect to vote for the deal, Kate Hoey, Gareth Snell, Lisa Nandy, John Curtis, and none of them are. And she only sort of met with them in Downing Street this week. So could she have done differently there?
Oh, well, they've been talking to Labour for a long time, actually.
I mean, Lisa Nandy said that she hadn't been contacted, even though she was openly considering voting for the deal.
Well, all I do know is that the chief whip has been talking to a lot of Labour MPs for some weeks now, but put that on one side. Authoritarian, I wouldn't actually describe the Prime Minister as being authoritarian because he doesn't exactly have a lot of authority at the moment. But the reality, I think, is that her deal, I think, for most people, doesn't do it for one side or the other. And it's a classic case. You can't please everybody in a deal. What you have to do is set out to do what was originally asked for, which is to leave the EU, and she said customs union, single market. There are certainly Labour MPs sitting in seats now which are very strongly for leave, who do want to make sure that we leave, and I've talked to many of them. But for them, many of them, this deal doesn't deliver, much like for many Conservatives.
And this is Kate from the IEA. Isn't the fundamental problem that while there are fatal flaws in the withdrawal agreement, there are serious issues with a no-deal Brexit as well? Voters for Leave and Remain did not vote to think that after 2.5 years, with MPs having one job to do, there would be no deal. So doesn't this, you know, even if we do crash out with no deal, aren't voters going to feel just as frustrated as if they were to get the withdrawal agreement?
Well, again, I don't know who has this fantastic insight into what the British voters wanted, didn't want, or did not, other than they voted to leave the European Union. We all keep this whole idea about crashing out with no deal. What we're talking about is if the EU does not want a withdrawal agreement because it won't agree to make the relevant changes that are necessary to this particular deal to make it palatable, if they don't want that, then we will go to World Trade Organization terms. And there are two things to be said about this. The first is 98% of all global trade is done under World Trade Organization terms. So the idea you're crashing into some utter darkness is complete nonsense.
There's no WTO country that trades only on WTO terms.
Well, of course, we're not going to train only on WTO terms.
There'd have to be other deals, of course.
But the EU has already made it clear. They've already made provision that should the UK have to leave without a withdrawal agreement, that they will have to reach an agreement on certain key and areas, such as the schedules. They've also said that they would look to see an extension of 6 to 9 months to prepare after the 29th to make sure that everything is put in place. There is also the gap round Article 24, which if both sides, and the EU has made it clear, Tusk made it clear, they want a trade deal. This is not the withdrawal agreement. The trade deal is a separate issue. If they want that trade deal and we both sign to that trade deal, in other words, we will carry on the negotiations on trade, which is exactly what we will do. You invoke
Donald Trump would want to exact a price for a deal, would he not?
You invoke Article 24 of GATT, which allows you to carry on your trade between each other while you're doing that at zero tariff.
Okay, you're not going to have to wind this one up.
Leaving under WTO. It's not a crashing out. It requires still, under the WTO, that we continue to make arrangements, and that's what we will have to do.
We could do an hour just on that if we try to. We haven't got an hour. We haven't got any more time at all. But it's good to talk to you, Ian Duncan-Smith. Thanks for coming on. I'm going to say now hello to, well, a rare guest on this programme. It's the former Liverpool and England footballer, Jamie Carragher, who's on the line. Morning, Jamie.
Morning.
All right, good to have you on. I know you're deeply anti-Brexit, which is one reason you're talking to us. I know you funded a campaign bus last year. I'm interested. I guess it was easier to do that, coming, wasn't it, from a city, Liverpool, which voted to remain. Would you still be doing it anyway if you were an ex-Burnley player?
Yeah, I think so. Listen, it's not about just the city that you're from. You make your own decisions. I think it was a massive thing at the time. I was well aware of that. It felt much bigger than a general election. And it was just, listen, I was asked to do it, get involved in it, and could you help? There was a rally, I think, going on in London and trying to get people down there to sort of let their voices be heard, Julian. And as I said, I backed that with plenty of other people. And yes, I was disappointed with the results a couple of years ago, and I still believe it will be the wrong decision if we finally leave the EU.
Tell me this, Jamie, because you are involved in this now. You're part of the effort to get a referendum, and you dislike Brexit. When you think about this, when you're talking to people in your normal daily life, how do you persuade Leave supporters that they got it wrong? People, they don't want to be shown they got it wrong. They want to be proved right, don't they? When you're involved in this conversation, or in future, maybe if you're campaigning, how do you win people over from there?
Well, I just look at the sort of the shambles that's gone on really for the last sort of couple of years, and just it's a mess, really. I'm not sort of coming on this show saying I know everything about the government or everything about Brexit, just speaking as you say, just a normal man on the street, if you like. And I actually think of all the things that could have been getting done in the country why we're going through all this now, really. And I do think that the people were lied to. There's no doubt about that. And also, I think the people involved in the Brexiteer side, I still believe a lot of them were desperate to be prime minister more than to get the UK or out of the European Union. Mm. I mean, I don't think Boris Johnson was desperately wanted to be a Brexiteer. I think he's publicly stated years ago in the past, I've seen interviews where he said it's better for us to stay in the EU. I think he was convinced by Michael Gove to go onto that side. I think Theresa May, who was a Remainer, didn't publicly speak out about that, sort of sat on the fence.
But a lot of people, Jamie, I mean, in politics, but also around the country, just in every walk of life, who supported Leave, they did it for perfectly clear reasons. They didn't like the European Union. They thought they were bound up by rules they didn't have enough of influence over. They were being ignored. You know the arguments. These were sincere views by people. They're not going to change easily. Poll shows they haven't changed easily.
No, I agree. If you lose a vote, you can't then say the other people are wrong. That's their opinion of how they see it. But there's no doubt when you speak to people after the vote and you're saying it hasn't changed too much, I agree with you. People don't like to admit maybe they were wrong. And listen, who knows? You know, we'll see in the future. Future will tell us that. But things that I'm talking about, those people who were involved, the thing on the bus, that's just a lie. And a lot of people were swayed by that bus and how it was going to help the NHS.
Who do you reckon would win a referendum, if there was one? Who do you think would win the next time round?
I'm convinced people would prefer to stay in the EU now. I don't think it would be a massive landslide, but I think it would be a lot more in favour of that. Because yeah. I think people who did vote that way, I think a lot of them feel now, looking back, it's going to be a lot easier.
And is it a big concern? I don't imagine you spend your entire life just talking to people in the football community, pundits, players, fans, whatever. But in that world, how big a concern is Brexit as you read it?
Well, people talk about the effect it'll have on it in terms of actually buying players from abroad. Would that help English players and things like that? You may look at that and think it's a good thing. I think it's fantastic that we get players from all over the world. And that's not just football. I think it's people coming into our country and doing whatever type of jobs and helping to enrich our country as well. And I think that should never be forgotten. And also the fact in the vote, I think a big thing for me was the age demographic of who voted for what. And it felt like the sort of older, middle-aged, older people generation voted for, we sort of want our country back. But the younger people seem to vote and love the idea of people coming to this country, also vice versa, us going to different countries. And for me, maybe people of my age, certainly younger, my own kids, I think it'll be it's not good going forward if we're out of the EU. Right.
I'm guessing we're going to be maybe looking to talk to you again in the future, depending on how this thing plays out. But it was good today. Jamie Carragher, thank you. And now, coming into the studio, there's Zara McDermott, a former civil servant, but a lot of people will know her better as a contestant on Love Island. Hello to you, Zara.
Hello.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And look, it's among those who follow these things closely, and that includes really rather a lot of people. You had things to say recently about Brexit. You didn't like it. Or whether you did support it. You're a Brexiteer, a Love Island Brexiteer, and you got a massive reaction to all of that. What about the scale of that? Because, you know, as a Love Islander, you get quite a lot of attention, especially on social media. Mm-hmm. How did that compare to the reactions of what you had to say in favour of Brexit?
For me, going on the Brexit blind dates that I went on, it was more so about being able to have a really open, honest discussion about Brexit with someone from a completely kind of different area to me with a different opinion. And for me, it was never about voicing my opinion. It was more about how educational these tapes were.
Yes.
And they really attracted a different kind of audience. I mean, normally I feel like young people aren't really too involved in politics generally, but I feel like these tapes really kind of bridged the gap between reality TV.
Just to be clear, for those who didn't see it, that's putting together one on each side of the Brexit argument on a kind of a date, and then we sort of see on screen how that went.
Exactly.
And then you had your say. I mean, you liked Brexit, mm-hmm. and there was quite a reaction, wasn't there? Tell us about that, because you got a bit of grief.
Yeah, I mean, quite a lot of grief online, a lot of abuse, to the point where I had to actually close down my Twitter account because it was that bad, which was quite difficult for me, for someone who's quite active on social media, to be able to have to take that down was quite a bold move, but quite an important one for me.
Yeah, and just give us a flavour of it. What, you were getting threats?
Yeah, I mean, death threats, all sorts of stuff. I won't go into too much detail, but it was absolutely vile, and something that I wouldn't want other people to be subjected to. And I think that leads us on quite well to the abuse that's been in kind of the political sphere over the last week or so.
Kate and Sienna.
I was wondering whether you notice who these threats and who this abuse was coming from. Was it other young people who like watched Love Island?
A variety of different people. I mean, a lot of young people, a lot of kind of middle-aged people. It really varied. So it was quite interesting. There was no key pattern for me.
Yeah.
I would be interested to know what it's been like to be off Twitter. I think the Westminster bubble is rather obsessed with the social media platform, myself included. I'm no exception to that. Have you found it healthier? Have you been enjoying your time a bit more to be away from that kind of abuse?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's frustrating at times, obviously, not being able to engage as much. But for me, my kind of sanity in a way is more important than that.
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah. Would you recommend to other young people as well that we need to step away from the phones a bit more?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think I've read a key statistic, which was that between 2015 and 2017, that there's been over double in abuse of MPs online. And for me, is that because people have become more kind of statistically politically opinionated? Yeah. Absolutely not. But I think we're being socialised to think that it's OK.
In a word, Zara, young people on balance are pretty much more likely to be against Brexit. There you are, in favour of it. You feel a bit odd, a bit left out of the argument?
Slightly, yes.
Just slightly. Okay, well, you're soldiering on, so there's something for that. Good to talk to you, Zara. Good to talk to everyone on the show today. We've run out of time, but we will be back, you can bet. What a week it's going to be coming up. That was PNR's Politics then for another week. A lot there to chew over and a lot more to come. But meanwhile, let's just talk about that hour just gone. Kate and Sienna still with me. What sticks with you, Kate?
What stuck out with me through all of the politician interviews, as well as those who members of the public who have a perspective on Brexit, is that it continues to be all about politics. And I guess you can't help that when it comes to politicians who do have ambitions in different parties. But, you know, we are weeks away now from what would still be the case of no deal on March the 29th. And that is still written in statute. If it does not go through, if there is no deal, we are leaving without one. And we just hear talk of the politics and the finger pointing and the point scoring. Mm. And, you know, I think a lot of members of the public listening to this are going to be very, very tired.
Well, the politics is very real and very practical with lots of implications for the future. It was interesting, wasn't it, to have Chris Grayling give that warning against members of parliament, seizing control of the agenda, what can be debated, what can be voted on, then what has to be done, taking that away from the government, the executive. This isn't America, as you know very well. Our government is an organ of parliament.
Exactly.
If the organ is overwhelmed by the wider body, it's got all sorts of implications.
Huge implications. We're setting major, major precedents if this goes through. And it could very well put at risk, you know, decades, if not a very long time period's worth of previous precedents. So it's dangerous, in my opinion. And I think it's extremely worrying that it has got to this point. Many people said Brexit was going to get over the line at the 11th hour. But I think many people expected better from the UK's politicians. That was supposed to be a discussion between the UK and the EU at the 11th hour. Not amongst their own parliament.
Would it be right for the government, the executive, to somehow bulldoze through its will? Let's say, because it's a big assumption and may well be wrong, that the Prime Minister would countenance a no-deal Brexit. But to bulldoze that through against the will of most members of parliament, could that be right?
I think it would be a very concerning thing to do, given the fact that they already agreed that they were going to give Parliament the vote. So in the same way that there was great frustration with the Speaker last week for abandoning precedent, it would be just as shameful if the government did it. The unfortunate news for them is they're going to have to come together at some point. And you can tell, and I think you could tell from the interviews in the studio today, from the Mayor of London to the Transport Secretary, there's not a lot of good political will to do that.
Sheila?
Yeah, I mean, as you were saying, Kate, it's all about the politics still, rather than the practicalities of the situation. But what's really surprising is how badly the politics is being done. I mean, as I said to Ian Duncan-Smith, there are all these Labour MPs with like heavily leave voting constituencies. They're Remainers, but they're flexible on this issue. And they were literally saying, I would consider voting for Theresa May's deal. This is, you know, something I'd be prepared to do for my constituents and, you know, to not undermine democratic faith in my constituency and all that. And yet there's Jim Fitzpatrick, maybe, John Mann, maybe, but you know, the others are saying that they're going to vote against her deal. That's a massive missed opportunity there. And that's just, there's so many bridges that could have been built and they weren't. And she prioritised her own party and her own backbenchers and keeping that together and completely failed on that level.
What do you think of Sadiq Khan and his contribution, Sienna?
Well, I think that was really interesting because obviously he was saying that, oh yeah, once we fail in getting the vote of no confidence through, then people's vote. But that is not what Labour's composite motion says. It says keeping people's vote as an option on the table. Yeah. And we all know that Jeremy is incredibly hesitant.
Do you reckon, you watch these things up close and personal, do you reckon Jeremy Corbyn in the end is going to have to give way to this?
I think it would take some doing to actually get him to that position. He really doesn't want that. I think, you know, he's already said he's advising Theresa May to go and renegotiate after the deal is voted down. He hasn't said, oh, we're changing our position necessarily after the vote of no confidence. He said, you should go and renegotiate a better deal, one that suits, you know, what we're asking for. So if Theresa May is prepared to say, you know what, fine, I'm going to negotiate a permanent customs union, then actually we could see Tories and Labour come together, you know, on a deal.
What does that mean for Labour? We focus, both of you, a great deal on the potential for, well, hardly potential, for splits and rifts on the Tory side and the potential in the future for some sort of schism. Mm. You know, the example of the Corn Laws just keeps coming over, back over and over again. What do you reckon? On the Labour side, there's a lot of potential for schisms and splits.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is the leader of an opposition who has been fundamentally Eurosceptic for decades now. You know, the idea that Jeremy Corbyn is absolutely desperate to stay a part of the single market and customs unions, which he has actively criticised as making it harder to implement some of his socialist agenda, is not totally surprising that this is a Labour leader who is hesitant to reverse this kind of vote. And I think you also have the issue that if Jeremy Corbyn were to come to power, a lot of the questions that would then be asked within the Labour Party to the moderates, are you going to support some of his agenda about nationalising 10% of big business, etc., etc.? Mm. You know, are they going to vote with him and support him in that way? And rightly, I think the focus is on the Tories right now because they are in charge, they are in power, and they need to be further scrutinised. But if Labour could theoretically be this close to taking power, the same questions will be asked to them.
Definitely. I mean, if they took power, you know, their party is so deeply split. And the membership, you know, the Corbynites themselves are being split on this issue. Obviously, as we know, there are pro-EU groups within Labour who, you know, Michael Chesham, for instance, another Europe as Possible, that group. And he was an organiser in Jeremy Corbyn's leadership contests and his campaigns, and he supported him. But they're now saying, look, we're fed up of this. I'm not sure why they didn't realise that he's been a Eurosceptic for decades, but that aside.
Evidence was there.
Yeah, it was all there for them to see.
It's just great having both of you on, so thanks again. Thank Don't you. Be a stranger. Come back soon. This programme will be back soon. But that's it for now. Bye-bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.